Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, a new biography about the judge who condemned Julius and Ethel Rosenberg to death. What does his life and times tell us about the unexpected ways judges act in the pursuit of justice? Tim Fagin interviews the author. And first, Niger and Gabon are the latest African nations to be toppled by military coups. What might these coups mean for the future of African governance? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. In the last 2 years, Africa has experienced a growing trend of military coups against civilian regimes. This month has seen coups in both Niger and Gabon. Niger's democratically elected president, Mohamed Bazoum, was overthrown by his military on July 26th. The military government has faced international pressure to return the president to power, but it shows no interest in surrendering power itself. In Gabon, on August 30th, President Ali Bongo was detained in his residence in what appears to be a military coup. Unlike Niger, Gabon is far from a democracy. We record the day after the Gabon coup. Reactions are still unfolding. On today's show, we will examine these two coups, their similarities, and their striking differences, and explore what it means for African governance. Our guest is Brett Logan Carter. He's an assistant professor of political science and international relations at the University of Southern California, and I'll note, a colleague of mine at USC. He's the author of Can Western Donors Constrain Repressive Governments? Evidence from Debt Relief Negotiations in Africa 2022, a forthcoming foreign affairs piece currently titled How the New Cold War Will Shape Africa's Future, and is the co-author of Propaganda in Autocracies, Institutions, Information, and the Politics of Belief, co-authored with Aaron Baggett-Carter. Rick Carter, thanks for joining us. First question, Niger. There's been a lot of reporting about the coup in Niger, but I wanted to get a bit of a deeper analysis. Why did the military in Niger overthrow the government? What were the conditions that led to that?
So, Doug, first, thanks so much for having me on. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm a big fan of the show. I think it's helpful to view this in two different ways. There's the proximate reason, and then I think there are a set of underlying reasons that I think are really essential to understanding why coups have spiked in recent years, and frankly also illuminate ongoing events in Gabon as well. The proximate reason for the coup in Niger on July 26th was, you know, as old as politics itself, right? A power struggle between the democratically elected president, Mohamed Bazoum, and the head of the Republican Guard. Bazoum, since he was elected a few years ago, has, I should say, in free and fair elections that were credited widely by the international community, has pursued a closer relationship with the United States, with other Western allies, which has really served in many ways to the benefit of Nigerian citizens. So the Sahel, as your listeners are probably aware, is increasingly the core theater for extremist violence in the world. Last year, it accounted for nearly 50% of civilian deaths compared to about 1% 15 years ago, right? So the Sahel is kind of really this hot seat for extremist violence. So there was some frustration within the Nigerian military about this closer attack with the West, which I should say included an American military base, which has some sophisticated drone technology that the U.S. uses for counterterrorism operations across the region. So the head of the Republican Guard, essentially, and I should say the Republican Guard is the president's kind of core personal security, generally comprised of loyalists. The head of the Republican Guard heard that he was likely to be removed. And so preemptively, he removed President Bazoum. So that's really the proximate reason, this underlying power struggle. But I think, you know, there are a set of broader factors that are really essential to understanding these ongoing events. First, since the end of the Cold War, there's been a marked decline in coups really across the world and certainly in sub-Saharan Africa. Whereas, you know, the vast majority of Africa's autocrats lost power during the Cold War as a result of elite power struggles, so think coups, civil wars, etc. Since the end of the Cold War, autocrats have overwhelmingly lost power due to threats from below, right? So think mass protests, think popular protests to abide the results of, you know, kind of reasonably free elections, popular pressure to abide term limits, right? Presidential term limits. There is a sense that this anti-coup norm is eroding. So starting in about 2020, the rate of coups essentially spiked. For the preceding 30 years since the Berlin Wall collapsed, the rate of coups had something, you know, like fallen by more than half relative to the Cold War period. It was really remarkable, and more failed than succeeded. Equally remarkable, right? So I mean, an equally fundamental change relative to the Cold War period. That all began in change in 2020. So the rate of coups has spiked, more succeeding now than failing. And so the coup in Niger is, you know, one really at this point, you know, across the continent. We mentioned Gabon. We could also talk about Mali, Burkina Faso, and a handful of other countries. There are a variety of reasons that this anti-coup norm took hold after the Berlin Wall collapsed. But I think the most widely accepted explanation is that the international community began to force newly ascendant military dictators to cede power to civilian, democratically elected governments. And so think about it then from the perspective, you know, a would-be military dictator. The risks of coups are, you know, obviously profound. And if the benefits from the coup are uncertain, right, given the fact that one might have to cede power soon, then, you know, again, coups become much less attractive. Anyway, so there's really been this kind of marked decline in the anti-coup norm since 2020, which I think is a real cause of concern, not just for the U.S. From a security perspective, but frankly, from a humanitarian perspective as well.
And I know there's kind of two different audiences that could potentially pressure military governments to surrender power once they've launched a coup: Western donors and African donors. Actually, I think I want to start with the African setting.
Yeah.
And I mean, for example, the African organizations, the AU, ECOWAS, you know, for example, had for a long time kind of just treated these are sovereign issues. We're not going to question who's going to govern. But the last decade and a half, at least, it seems like they've become a lot more aggressive, wanting to overthrow the government. Why has that not been successful in this recent trend?
I think there are two things that are driving. There are a few things to consider. So for a long time, you know, kind of the core threat that African presidents confronted were, you know, civil wars, secessions, et cetera. And so for a long time, you know, the AU and its predecessor, the Organization for African Unity, the OAU, were overwhelmingly concerned with maintaining borders that governments essentially inherited upon independence around 1960 or so. But as the anti-coup norm has receded, you know, there's been, you know, new concern that African presidents could fall victim to these coups as well. And so consequently, the AU, ECOWAS, other regional institutions, you know, have become very vocal in terms of condemning them. And you know, there's some real, and I want to emphasize that, especially on the AU side, there's some real irony in this. So for instance, the current day-to-day president of the African Union is Moussa Faki. Moussa Faki was for a long time Idriss Déby was the former dictator of Chad, who was killed in a visit to a military base about a year and a half ago, who, by the way, we can also talk about. His son took power, and his son is sort of, you know, enmeshed in the same kinds of geopolitical struggles that I think are central to understanding ongoing events in Niger and Gabon. In any event, Moussa Faki was, for a long time, Idriss Déby's prime minister and his foreign affairs minister, which is to say that Moussa Faki served one of the continent's dictators who had, you know, one of the worst human rights records of economic corruption, right? So, there is something, you know, very ironic about, you know, the AU's current leadership in condemning coups, right? I mean, they certainly haven't condemned with any regularity, massively fraudulent elections, right? That it just to be, Bazoum's predecessors, you know, Sassou Nguesso, Bongo and Gabon, et cetera, have organized. It's worth underscoring that. But there's also, I think, another angle to this, especially from the ECOWAS perspective. And I think this actually tells us something really fundamental about the implications from kind of this current, you know, new era of geopolitical competition. So your listeners might recall that in 2017, January 20th, 21st, 2017, Yahya Jammeh, who had ruled the Gambia for roughly the preceding two decades, and, you know, in the meantime, had again acquired, you know, among the continent's worst human rights records, a horrible record of economic mismanagement, you know, ruled among, you know, the world's poorest countries. Yahya Jammeh tried to rig an election. He did so in a very skillless way, I suppose, is the euphemistic way of putting it. Remarkably, ECOWAS essentially forced him to step down in favor of his neophyte rival, the current president, Adama Barrow, threatening military intervention. The ECOWAS intervention was, in this case, led by Senegal, which borders the Gambia on all three sides, basically because of kind of a weird legacy of colonialism. Whenever France took Senegal, Britain took the Gambia, which basically has the Gambia River, which provided kind of an entry point into, into the western part of the continent. Anyway, so Senegal, the Senegalese government, essentially coordinated the ECOWAS intervention force, forced Jammeh to resign. Now, for the Nigerian coup, the Nigerian government has coordinated this this ECOWAS force, threatened to intervene militarily if the coup plotters didn't release Bazoum and restore him to the presidency. What's fascinating, though, is the extent to which other regional powers, think in particular the new military governments in Mali and Burkina Faso, and also Moscow, have threatened intervention if an ECOWAS force intervened, right? This is a fundamental distinction between what happened in the Gambia in 2017 and what's going on now. So kind of the broader geopolitical point is that increasingly the African continent is a theater of kind of these proxy kind of influence battles that marked the Cold War, but that then subsided when the Berlin Wall collapsed. So the Malian and Burkina-Bé military regimes are backed by Moscow, in particular the Wagner Group, which has been implicated in a series of atrocities, but which has provided the Malian and Burkina-Bé governments, weapons, security, some assistance against rebels. There's a real sense that the Nigerian coup, if it didn't, there's no evidence, I should be clear, that it received active support from Moscow. I should be clear about that. But there are networks, informal communications networks, that link governments really across the continent, but certainly within regions. And so in some sense, it would be surprising, given Niger's natural resource wealth, think uranium potentially, that the Wagner Group would certainly, Moscow would certainly be keen to exploit. So I mean, it would be surprising if there wasn't some at least sort of implication, I think, which is, I think, again, sort of how to kind of understand the Nigerian coup more broadly.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we are discussing coups in Africa, particularly coups in Niger and in Gabon, with Brett Logan Carter of the University of Southern California. And I want to shift attention at this point now to Gabon, because unlike Niger, which by all accounts, democratic, governments and some real positive steps in governance and responding to questions about transparency and questions about democratic norms, Gabon is far from a democracy. What was the government that was overthrown, and what were the motivations for the coup?
So the circumstances surrounding the coup in Gabon are much different than those surrounding Niger, but I think these kind of underlying structural forces that have eroded the anti-coup norm across the continent are salient in Gabon as well. So the Bongo family first took power in 1967. Ali, the former president, as of yesterday morning, succeeded his father upon his death in 2009. His father, Omar Bongo, took power in 1967. And so, ruled for what, about 42 years. Omar Bongo was, kind of the personification of Françafrique, which is to say, kind of the kind of neo-colonial policies pursued by the French government for much of the Cold War period, and frankly since as well. So France was devastated after World War II, and so Charles de Gaulle set about building or rebuilding the French economy, and he did so in part by trying to secure cheap oil. He created two companies to do so: Total, focused on the Middle East and North Africa; ELF, focused on Sub-Saharan Africa. So whenever deep water exploration, drilling, extraction technology kind of improved in, kind of the late 60s, early 70s, it essentially opened up the African market for oil. Gabon was among the first places where it was discovered. Gabon was a former French colony. And so consequently, the De Gaulle government, Paris more broadly, had perceived a pretty strong interest in supporting the Bongo regime. Paris made Bongo extraordinarily wealthy in exchange for selling oil to Paris at far below market price. Not only did Paris make Bongo extraordinarily wealthy, it also guaranteed his personal security, in part with a tunnel that connected the presidential palace in Libreville, the capital, to a French military base. And so, I mean, in a very real sense, Paris guaranteed his security. Between 1967 and 2009, Gabonese oil production spiked. You know, obviously, global oil prices rose. The standards of living of virtually all Gabonese citizens essentially remained constant, essentially stagnated. And so consequently, Omar Bongo, the Bongo family broadly, amassed really one of the world's kind of worst records of corruption. Later, French journalists discovered, some 40 properties in and around Paris that Bongo had amassed. So we talk a lot about Leningrad, right? Leningrad being the site of, lots of kind of Russian oligarch oil wealth. One, kind of tell the same story about Paris with Central Africa's dictators. So whenever Omar Bongo died in 2009, his son Ali succeeded him. Ali, for a long time, was his father's defense minister. Ali won two elections, and this was going to be the third. About an hour after the results were announced, which, unsurprisingly, showed Bongo with somewhere around 70% of the vote, which is sort of absurd, the military announced the coup. One of the things that is most striking about this coup is that it was led in part by his cousin, Brice Oligui Nguema, who was also head of Ali's Republican Guard, which is, again, kind of responsible for his core security. So again, both of these coups were launched by heads of the Republican Guard. Ali's, of course, was his cousin. There is, lots of evidence, that obviously Brice Oligui is part of the kind of the same Bongo system that's dominated Gabon since 1967. We have some information about his real estate assets in Maryland. Actually, in the past years, he's purchased three different properties worth a bit over $1 million, which is notable, but certainly by the standards of Central Africa, is not so much, right? Which I think underscores the extent to which the benefits of the oil wealth controlled by the family didn't really trickle down to other parts of the family, and certainly the vast majority of the country's citizens.
Now, in the case of Niger, you've seen quite a bit of international opposition in Africa as well as, in Europe, the United States. It's still very early, obviously, with Gabon. States are still responding to it. But are you getting a sense that this is a coup that's being celebrated because of a family dynastic, quasi-democratic, actually quite undemocratic government in Gabon, that basically international actors are saying, good riddance, let's see if this can improve Gabonese government? Or is there a rallying against the coup just because of the tycoon norm?
I think there are a few ways to think about this. First, it's certainly being celebrated by the vast majority of Gabonese citizens who, after 56 years of Omar and his son Ali, are desperate for change, right? So there are images of Gabonese citizens in the streets giving beers to soldiers, defacing Ali Bongo campaign posters, and just in general, celebrating the end of what they hope is this Bongo regime. I think the reality, unfortunately, is that very little will change. Brice Oligui, the presumed new president, is again, from the system, kind of a sort of distant cousin of Ali. And, in general, increasingly military governments have very poor records within the past five or so years, very poor records of ceding power back to democratically elected civilian governments. Think what happened after the Sudanese revolution that toppled Omar al-Bashir. So I think the prospects that most citizens' aspirations will be satisfied are unfortunately pretty low, and I want to be clear about that. So as much as the coup is greeted with jubilation, I suppose I'm less optimistic. But second, the AU was predictably quick to condemn the coup, right? There was again Mustafa Faki, who had served as Egypt Studies Prime Minister, Foreign Affairs Minister, condemning the coup in the most strident terms, while of course not condemning any of the previous electoral fraud that had secured the Bongo family for 56 years and obviously other non-democratic governments across the continent. France, I think, had a more measured response. I think they are kind of generally confident, probably, that kind of the system will remain in place. They have still very strong oil interests in the country. And then fourth, Washington has for a long time, I think, deferred to Paris when it comes to politics in Francophone Africa, especially in Central Africa, where French oil interests are strongest. So again, think places, think the Republic of Congo, Gabon, Cameroon, etc. So there hasn't been, apart from the AU, the sort of international condemnation that followed the Niger coup, again, because, there aren't the same kind of strategic interests for Washington, in Gabon as there are currently in the Sahel.
We have about 90 seconds left, but I'll ask a big broad question that is deserving of much more time. In the last 10 years or so, there was a kind of African optimism. This we saw in places across East Africa, across Southern Africa, these economies that seemed ready to take off versus the 90s in particular, which was a real, African pessimism. At this point, are you more optimistic or pessimistic about Africa's future?
I think at the moment I'm much more pessimistic. You're absolutely right. In the 1990s and really, on to probably about 5 years ago, the Africa Rising narrative was salient in the press and I think well-deserved, right? Middle classes were booming. Tech sectors were blossoming. Africa experienced the same economic takeoff that has occurred in, really across Asia, especially in the continent's democracies. Increasingly over the past 5 years, the trend has been towards democratic erosion, democratic backsliding, certainly, of the sort that that we've just seen in Niger, in Mali, in Burkina Faso. And then, of course, the continent's remaining autocracies entrenching themselves. Think Paul Kagame in Rwanda, Sudan, with really the collapse of the revolution that toppled Omar al-Bashir. And has now led to horrible violence, in Khartoum. Anyway, so I think at this point, I'm much more pessimistic, and again, that has, we can't really overstate the humanitarian consequences of that.
Absolutely. It seems to me Africa remains a continent of tremendous potential, tremendous growth, but governance structures, problems with governance, lack of democracy, autocracy, corruption, etc., gets in the way. And the real victims of all of this is, of course, the African people. We've been discussing the military coups in Niger and Gabon and general questions of African governance. Our guest today has been Brett Logan Carter. He's an assistant professor of political science and international relations at the University of Southern California. He's the author of Can Western Donors Constrain Repressive Governments? Evidence from Debt Relief Negotiations in Africa in 2022. The forthcoming, currently titled How the New Cold War Will Shape Africa's Future. This is going to be in Foreign Affairs and is the co-author of Propaganda in Autocracies, Institutions, Information, and the Politics of Belief. And it's co-authored with Aaron Baggett Carter. Brett Carter, thank you very much for joining us and sharing your expertise.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much, Doug.
When we come back, the judge who sentenced the Rosenbergs to death. What does his life tell us about judges and their decisions? Tim Fadjin interviews the author. Stay with us.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Tim Fadjin. The political and social turmoil of the past several years have again thrust the role of courts and judges into public consciousness. With public confidence in public institutions at an all-time low, what we expect of judges and, more importantly, the American justice system is under the microscope. The recent indictments of former President Donald Trump have also exposed the judicial system to a stress test. Can justice be meted out in such difficult social and political circumstances as these? How can judges preserve and promote justice as fairness in such an environment of social division and fervent political passions? To gain perspective, we might look to past turbulent times and ask how judges and the judiciary responded to them. The 20th century witnessed many instances of moral panic and uncertainty. By many accounts, our courts and judges performed admirably as a backstop to these political and social challenges. Yet this is not to say this period was without instances that were viewed by many within their own time, and even more today, as excessive exercises of state authority. Perhaps one of the most notable examples of such excess is provided in the infamous case of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, who were executed for espionage for the USSR just over 70 years ago. The judge who condemned them to death, Irving Robert Kaufman, would later be elevated from trial to appellate judge for the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. But perhaps surprisingly to some listeners, later decided many cases in a decidedly liberal way and become a critic of originalism in constitutional interpretation. Kaufman was also well known for his difficult, often abusive personality and sometimes questionable ethical practices in carrying out his responsibilities. Today we will talk with Martin J. Siegel, author of a recent book on Judge Irving Kaufman, titled Judgment and Mercy: The Turbulent Life and Times of the Judge Who Condemned the Rosenbergs. Martin is a former law clerk for Judge Kaufman and now practices law in Houston, Texas, where he also teaches law and appellate civil rights practice at the University of Houston Law Center. So welcome, Martin Siegel.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Irving Kaufman is not exactly a household name, even in lawyer households. What prompted you to write this book now?
My kids might disagree with that. He's been a household name around here for a while. Right. Most households and most lawyer households, you're right, he's not. But it's not correct to say that I wrote it now. I actually have been working on this for a very, very long time. I really started working on it pretty shortly after my clerkship with the judge ended, and it ended in February 1992 when he died. So I started work for him in August of 91. It was supposed to be a year-long job. He died about halfway through. Even then, I thought he was a fascinating character, had been involved in so many famous cases. I was sitting there in his chambers alone eventually. My coworkers sort of been reassigned elsewhere in the court, and I stuck around in that office for weeks. And eventually, the Library of Congress showed up to take his files away, and that sort of just catalyzed in my mind the idea that, you know, one day I might be back with those files working on a book. And I didn't know if anybody else would write it. And you know, I'm not a professional historian, so it was going to be a sort of thing that I was going to do in my spare time. But I began that in 1994. And over the years, when I had little bits of time here and there, I would work on it between jobs or if my law practice, you know, was a little bit slower. I'm a practicing lawyer. And I did a fair amount of work that way up until about 2016, where I really decided, you know what, if this is really going to get finished, I'm going to have to devote full time to it. And so that's what I did. But you're right. The question is good. There's nothing that would suddenly suggest, you know, we need a book about Irving Kaufman. It is the 70th anniversary of the Rosenberg's execution, so that's somewhat timely. It's more that I just eventually was able to finish it.
You had been a clerk for Kaufman. Through the research you did for your book, you talked with many people who had worked and known Irving Kaufman. And it really struck me that there are really several relationship strands that you weave together in telling his story. There was, as you mentioned, Kaufman the jurist, but also Kaufman the son, brother, husband, father. And at the center of each of these are these challenges and hardships that you talk about, these challenges within his family, as a child, later as an average student, those as a young man entering the legal profession in a city with many closed doors to him as a Jewish man from the Lower East Side. professional challenges, the politics involved in navigating these barriers to reach his goals, his professional goals, and the importance of playing politics in a way to advance, which is still incumbent in how judges sort of navigate things today. I also thought that the experiences that the clerks had and others in the courtroom with him was really striking. So what did you find most surprising about what you learned about Kaufman?
All those sort of different facets of his life and different relationships, you're right. I mean, I tried to delve as far as I could into each of those and show the full, you know, picture of the man, not just the jurist, but also his, like you say, his rise from Lower East Side poverty and anonymity, certainly not from any kind of prominent or wealthy family, but very much a self-made person. And you're also right, in a profession that in the 1930s, when he was starting out, was not closed to Jews in the sense that Jews couldn't be lawyers, but the prominent law firms and larger law firms and corporate practices, they rarely hired Jews. And so Jews coming out of law schools in the 30s, especially in the Depression, when they're already, the field was contracted, had little choice but to be their own sole practitioners or to join very small practices with other Jewish lawyers. So for him, what really made his success and started him on his way was the U.S. Attorney's Office. He became a federal prosecutor in 1935 and handled a number of prominent cases that landed him in the news, made him semi-famous in New York, kind of in the mold of a more famous corruption, you know, anti-corruption crusader there, Tom Dewey, who had been in that office as well before he became DA. And then you also referred to, you know, the sort of politicking that goes on. Kaufman was a master at that. That's something, I will say, it surprised me because I knew he had done that. It was consistent with his personality, even as I knew it. But the sort of skill and length and breadth with which he achieved that in the 1940s, cultivating patrons like J. Edgar Hoover and like Tom Clark, who was a high official in the Truman Justice Department and then eventually became a justice after being attorney general. He was a real patron to Kaufman. So just seeing, sort of getting into the files and the paperwork and seeing him kind of work that way, again, not fully surprising, but I admired, you couldn't help but admire the skill with which it happened. And also, you know, you mentioned his family life. That was a surprise to me. That's something I knew a lot less about when I started this. I knew when I clerked for Judge Kaufman in, as I said, 91 and 92, only one of his three sons were still alive. Two of his three had predeceased him. And I didn't really know why, and I knew very little about his family life. And the more that I did that research and connected with existing family members, in particular his grandkids, I learned that it was not always a happy family life. He was just as he was with law clerks, he was an extremely stern taskmaster to his kids, who often felt like nothing was ever good enough. And they grew up in this pressure cooker with bomb threats in the Rosenberg case and the kind of resulting fame of their father, guarded by the FBI, kind of both the positive and the negative. Their father was lionized as a hero in the 50s, at least at first, when there wasn't as much dissent about the Rosenberg case, although there was some. But later he became an even more controversial figure. And for example, he presided over a mafia case in the late 1950s that resulted in a bomb threat for one of his kids at college. So it just was a sort of tumultuous atmosphere and not one that Kaufman always made loving for his kids, although I believe he did love his kids and he tried to be a good father, but it resulted in tragedy and that there was mental illness among his kids and substance abuse that no doubt had complex factors and causes, but his living relatives, the one I spoke to, connected it to the Rosenberg controversy and the pressure that family was under for so many years. They thought that played a role.
I learned a great deal from your research on this, in particular, the adoption of the Rosenberg children and their eventual fight years later to clear their birth parents' names. I suppose for me, the reality of the executions, the orphaning of the children, is what struck me the most, something I hadn't really reflected on before reading your book. Do you think that this is what caused Kaufman so much angst after the fact? Had the Rosenbergs had grown children or never had children, would this have caused him so much stress about the decision, or was it something else?
Well, I think you're onto something. I mean, I think it contributed to what he referred to both in open court, and if I'm remembering correctly, I think in his second written decision about it as well, it contributed to what he called the tragedy of the case. And that's like using a third person or something, that kind of distanced him from a cause of the being one of the causes of the tragedy, namely the executions. Of course, he was the person who decided that the Rosenberg should get the death penalty. But he recognized the tragedy there. And it was tragic because of two young children that the Rosenbergs had. The Rosenbergs themselves were young people in their 30s during the time of the case. And their children were under 10 years old. And so that became a real point of rallying, I guess, for Rosenberg, for people who objected to the sentences before they were carried out, and then in later years for people who looked back on the case and thought there'd been an injustice. And I do believe, you know, Kaufman had young children himself at the same time. He was only a little bit older than the Rosenbergs, and they'd come from the same kind of background in New York City. They'd started on the Lower East Side. Kaufman then grew up in Harlem, where Julius Rosenberg lived for a time, in Jewish Harlem. They'd had kind of the same backgrounds until, you know, they took sharply different routes as Kaufman became successful in the typical kind of climb up the ladder in law and politics and in government, and financially he became quite well off. And the Rosenbergs, you know, took the other route into left-wing politics and ultimately the Communist Party, obviously a route taken by a lot of other people in New York City, in the Jewish community as well, in the Depression, and for some even in the years after. I think it was the kind of personal way in which the case presented itself to him that in part shaped his reaction. But I wouldn't, part of your question was, is that what caused him angst over the years? I think largely what caused him angst was the sort of unexpected shift in public sentiment. Right after the sentences were imposed, they were widely popular. And there weren't, of course, this is the height of McCarthyism. It's 1951. And there weren't many voices really raised in objection to the sentences. That gradually changed over the next 2 years before their execution in 1953. And there were, by the few months or so before the execution leading up to the day of, there were public demonstrations and there were letter writing campaigns. Even so, those people remained a fairly small minority of Americans. And even in the Jewish community, a lot of those people who opposed the sentence were Jewish, but I think the sentences were essentially popular in the Jewish community as they were nationally. So I think what troubled Judge Kaufman is when that changed over the years. By the late 1960s and then into the 70s, it was a very different time. And people began to look back on those sentences and think that they'd been a sort of gross overreaction and an example of McCarthyite, you know, fear, basically, and paranoia. And people began to maintain that the Rosenbergs were innocent. The Rosenbergs' children took up the cause of their parents' case. They'd come of age at that point. They came out publicly as the Rosenbergs' children, even though they had a different last name because they were raised by a different couple. And they claimed that their parents had been framed, which there wasn't very much evidence for, but you have to understand, this is now after Vietnam, and then it's after Watergate, and people are much more willing in the early 70s than they had been in the early 50s to disbelieve the government, to believe that the government might actually do that to somebody, might make stuff up and frame them. There'd been a loss of institutional trust because of lies in Vietnam and the lies of Watergate. And so that campaign really gained currency, and that did cause Kaufman a lot of angst, as well as the revelation with records that came out from the FBI in the 1970s that he had had ex parte illegal contacts with the prosecution. In other words, secret meetings with the prosecution team out of the presence of the defense lawyers that, although more common then, were nonetheless a sort of ethical violation by the court. That also brought him in for a great deal of sudden criticism. So this, I think it was this turn from national hero to a kind of, in a lot of places, reviled figure by the mid and late 70s that really, really shook him.
I think to lawyers and non-lawyers alike, the revelations of these ex parte communications, and particularly the way that you tell the story of that in the book, are quite surprising and certainly undermine some confidence in the case itself. I guess I was also struck, too, by your telling of it was almost immediately after the decision and Kaufman and sort of in real time responding to the reaction and sensed that perhaps this, you know, he was given a difficult decision under the law at the time, right? He felt that he could only give a very, in his mind, a light sentence in terms of years or death. So he chose door number two.
He was sentencing them under the 1917 Espionage Act at the time. And of course, people today would assume that if someone's going to be sentenced to death, that the alternative is life in prison. That Judge Kaufman, therefore, looking back on the case, would have had the option to sentence them to life in prison. That's actually not true. As you say, the two alternatives were starkly different. The maximum prison term he could give back then was 30 years. And the key thing to keep in mind is, unlike today in the federal system, back then there was a lot of parole. Today in the federal criminal system, there is almost no parole. That all kind of went away in the 1980s. But back then it was much more like state systems are, where you weren't going to serve, you know, all of that sentence. And Judge Kaufman well knew that if he sentenced them to 30 years, they could be out in 20 or possibly even 15. As in fact happened with the two who went to prison, Sobel and David Greenglass. They didn't serve the entirety of their sentences. And so for Judge Kaufman, he was looking at something more like 15 or 20 years, which he thought was, you know, too light. But you're right, it put him in door. He then had to go through door number two, which was, you know, I think the judgment of history is was too severe.
You tell that story after about how recognizing this, he was sort of hoping that perhaps either the Supreme Court on an appeal or President Truman might intervene to sort of get him off the hook. Did you know that going in to your research, or how'd you come upon that?
That's a great question, because the way I came upon that was very shortly after his death in 1992. The New York Times ran its expected sort of obituary. And a couple of weeks later, a person wrote in a letter to the editor, and that person had been if I'm remembering correctly, a Justice Department lawyer who recounted the story of someone at the White House, an aide to Truman, and that aide was someone who handled Jewish political affairs in the White House, among other things, sort of a Democratic Party politico type, called up this lawyer in the Justice Department. I think they knew each other personally. And asked, you know, what he thought of the sentence. And he said that the judge had reached out to President Truman was essentially sort of thumbing around, or, you know, like nosing around and implying that maybe the president should commute the sentences, commute them to life in prison, which the president would have the power to do. And the answer came back from the president after these two got together, and then President Truman thought about it. The answer, according to this person who wrote it at the Times, the answer came back, well, if the judge thinks the Senate should be reduced, then he should do it himself. And by the way, this is in the waning days of the Truman administration. This is after the 52 election. When, you know, theoretically, President Truman might have a little more, you know, he'd feel politically freer to do something like that. That when I read that, although it was before I started on the book, that was a surprise. I guess the reason it was a surprise, and this continues to be true, is that it's not mentioned anywhere else. I was surprised over the years as I read more and more about the case. There have been a number of books written about the case, including some after 1992, that didn't mention that at all. Now, I couldn't confirm that in President Truman's papers. There was no record I could find of that phone call. The White House official who's mentioned, I did a little research on him, and he apparently was famous for destroying his files every Christmas. So that year, so he wanted no record of his work in the White House, and you know, any notes he might have had are gone. So, but I believe the account, because it is a lot like Judge Kaufman, and I to sort of do that kind of back channel politicking. He did that in a lot of areas of his life. I can see how that would appeal to him, because he would look tough for having sentenced them to the maximum, treated them as traitors, and yet he wouldn't get the downside of executing these young parents and the sort of tragedy of that. So I see the appeal to him, and I think it likely did happen. I don't know why else that person, I don't think that person would make it up.
You are listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Tim Fadjan. We are discussing the book Judgment and Mercy, The Turbulent Life and Times of the Judge Who Condemned the Rosenbergs, with the author, Martin Siegel. So moving on from the Rosenbergs, you write at length about Kaufman's many other notable decisions. For those unfamiliar with the man or his work, he decided cases on free speech against the Vietnam War, immigration cases like the matter involving the proposed deportation of John Lennon, cases stemming from the Pentagon Papers, school desegregation, all emphatically on the side of what most would consider the liberal side of the cases. One of the questions you pose in the book is whether this was a natural outcome for Kaufman in his time, coming of age in the New Deal and the role of courts in protecting individuals from government overreach, or if he was, on the other hand, somehow trying to even the score or sort of overcome the burden of the Rosenberg case. Now, after reviewing Kaufman's record, his writings, where do you fall on this?
Yeah, so the reason I wanted to answer that question is because and it is the sort of like really the fundamental question I guess I'm posing and trying to grapple with in the book. And the reason it comes up is because so many people who knew Kaufman and knew his career, that's kind of how they dismissed him and summed him up. He had a lifetime, decades of progressive rulings, a lot of them very important, some of them you mentioned right there. The typical story on him was this is just atonement for the Rosenberg case. And they meant that in two senses, the sort of, good faith way to sort of mean that was that he truly felt something akin to guilt or wanted to sort of land on the other side, I guess, after the Rosenberg case. Such a controversial decision, one that had him described in a lot of quarters as a reactionary McCarthyite. And so one way to look at that theory about him was that in all genuineness, he felt bad about it at some level and was trying to make up for it. But the more cynical way that kind of idea was presented often was that really all he cared about was image, and that his sort of public reputation was paramount to him. He was very close to the New York Times, knew the publisher personally and other high officers there. And so this kind of way of thinking about him is that really all that mattered to him is how he was going to be portrayed in the Times and whether he was going to be able to remain in the good graces of polite society on the Upper East Side, which tended generally to be liberal. So what do I, to answer your question, what's my view of that? I think that's too simplistic. I think there's some truth to it. He was quite image conscious. That's certainly true. He was insecure in a lot of ways. He wanted desperately to be covered by the Times and other newspapers. He wrote, not only was he the object of coverage for years and years, but he often contributed op-ed pieces and other pieces for the New York Times Magazine. So he cared quite a lot about his reputation and how he was viewed in New York and beyond. And the Times was his key vehicle for that. So that's true. But I don't think it really captures it. I think his turn to progressivism was genuine and really came from a couple of places. First, of course, he was in tune with his times politically and judicially. He came of age as a sort of Truman Democrat. He was an active political Democrat in the 1940s. He raised money for the Democratic Party and so on, became close to Democratic Party figures. And in the 50s and 60s, the court, which had largely been appointed by Democratic presidents, turned ever more liberal under Earl Warren. The Warren-era court expanded civil liberties and the protections for criminal defendants and free speech and achieved a really sort of a constitutional revolution that Kaufman joined in on. And to the degree he could, from an inferior position on a lower court, tried to push the envelope of certainly in free press rulings, but also in rulings about prisoners' rights and criminal defendants and the degree to which the federal government could intervene in state convictions and state criminal processes. and in a number of other areas. So he sort of wasn't only a follower of the Warren Court, he sort of pushed the envelope as well, and expanded the frontier of civil rights for a lot of people. So I think part of it is that, but part of it goes even deeper, and it really is his background, I think, as a poor outsider New Yorker who sort of came from nothing. And the sort of best evidence I found supporting that came from his files. It was something he wrote right when he was appointed in 1949. He's only 39 years old, second youngest judge in America at the time. And this document it reads kind of like a speech, like you would give at a reception where your friends have gathered to kind of congratulate you on this appointment. And it's also important to me because it wasn't written by somebody else. You know, the more prominent he became and the more he was surrounded by law clerks and aides, you know, like anybody in that position, there's a lot of ghostwriting going on, people writing for him, which of course he would review and it sort of adopt as his own. But this is something he wrote personally. And so I think it had real meaning. And I just wanted to just read it, I think is better than paraphrasing it, just so you'll know exactly what he said. He says, "As I look around, my mind goes back to my early youth, the son of immigrants, and I promise you and all my other friends that I shall endeavor and hope to be privileged to make it a lot easier for those who are now struggling like I did 20 years ago. Only in such a fashion can I reward the faith placed in me by this great distinction." So a couple of things really jumped out at me when I ran across that document. One is that he almost never in later life referred to his difficult childhood and his sort of impoverished childhood. So this reference to struggling like I did 20 years ago, that was extremely rare for him to reference. I think in later life, he was embarrassed by it a little bit and wanted people to see him as just, you know, this successful resident of the Upper East Side in the legal elite. This was the only reference I could really find where he's sort of acknowledging his rise. And the second thing is, he talks about, as a judge, making it easier for those who are struggling. And that's not something judges usually sort of overtly say. Judges usually they talk about, you know, applying the law equally and being neutral and even-handed, and they talk about justice. They don't overtly say, "I want to help people who are struggling." So both of those things really made an impression on me. And I think that the point of this sort of long monologue here is that seed of his later progressivism was there from the beginning. And so I think it refutes the notion that his progressivism really was all just an act atoning for the Roseburg case.
When people try to put judges into this box, and you're a liberal judge or you're a conservative judge, Kaufman's that quest for justice, as you talk about it, if you look at the outcome of the Roseburg case versus like Phil Artiga, like where there's just this, that you can see that there's a quest for justice in both instances from his perspective. And we put this kind of tremendous burden on judges to have to make these difficult decisions. And our own political views of the outcome and justness of a case don't always fit. And judges don't always have that convenience of looking at it that way.
No, that's exactly right. They're often the controversial cases, the high stakes cases, the ones that present new questions that tug at the heartstrings either way, they're extremely difficult. And judges don't often, as you say, they don't always get the sort of benefit of the doubt. They're often also, again, the uniquely important and novel ones, they can sometimes be answered satisfactorily either way. You know, you can construct rationales and arguments that would support one decision or the other. That's what makes them hard cases. You know, that isn't true of 85% of cases that judges decide. A lot of what they do is routine, but those aren't the cases we remember. And Kaufman had a sort of unusual, for a lower court judge, he had an unusual number that still are important and that we do remember. And you're right, they were hard cases. And I do think he was focused on justice. That's kind of the point I make in the sort of final analysis in the epilogue. He's not remembered among lawyers who know that era of the federal courts, especially in New York. He's not remembered as the most brilliant. He's not remembered as the greatest legal technician. You know, there were other judges who had sort of higher scholarly attainment or deeper explications of this or that area of the law. But he did search for justice. as he saw it. And I think you mentioned Phil Ortega, which I devote a whole chapter to. That's the case holding that people who are victims of human rights violations all over the world can sue the people who committed those violations if they happen to be found in the U.S. in an American court, even though the violation really didn't have any connection to America. That's an extraordinarily important decision. It opened up a whole new area of international human rights law. The Supreme Court has since cut back on it here in the United States, but it remains more vibrant outside the United States. It's, you know, helped Holocaust victims and people victimized by the Marcos regime and people from the Balkan Wars in the 90s, all of those people brought lawsuits in the United States, and many of them recovered compensation due to an area of law that Judge Kaufman kind of began. And that was toward the end of his career, long after the Rosenberg episode. And that was a novel case. He was the first one to do that, to interpret a very old federal law to allow that. And I think what led him in that direction was a basic sense of justice and fairness. And in fact, he found himself kind of against, on the other side of the judge who's remembered in New York on the Second Circuit as the most sort of intellectually impressive judge Henry Friendly, who was a more conservative judge, who was a sort of quite impressive technician of the law, but at least in that area, I would argue, didn't have the sense of justice that Judge Kaufman did. And I think Judge Kaufman sort of ended up with the right result.
Thank you for speaking with us today, Martin.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it. Appreciate you having me.
With me today was Martin Siegel, the author of the recent book, Judgment and Mercy, The Turbulent Life and Times of the Judge Who Condemned the Rosenbergs. He is a former law clerk to Judge Kaufman and now practices law in Houston, where he also teaches at the University of Houston Law Center and directs the Appellate Civil Rights Clinic.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Mahika Chechi is our assistant producer. Seth Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.